Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. Today we're joined by Professor Brian Victoria, who's the Professor of Japanese Studies at Antioch University. We're going to be talking about the broad subject of religion and violence, but with a specific focus upon Buddhism, which I think I'm fairly safe to say isn't something that most people would jump to when they think about religion and violence. Dr. Victoria has led the Japan and its Buddhist Traditions program for Antioch Education Abroad since 2005. He's a fully ordained Soto Zen priest, and he's the author and co-author of numerous books and articles on Zen, including Zen Master Dogen, Zen at War, and Zen War Stories. We're going to be talking a lot today about an article that Dr. Victoria has published online entitled Holy War Towards a Holistic Understanding, and we'll link to that from the podcast page. And we'd really encourage you, if you want to delve into some of what we're talking about in more depth, to please have a look at that. So first off, Professor Victoria, or Brian, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chris.
So before we start talking about religion and violence, just why are we talking about it at all?
Well, you know, Martin Marty is a professor of religion at the University of Chicago, and I think he said it best. You know, we usually, when we talk about religion, we normally turn to the religious or the church page of our local newspaper and which service is offered at what time. But occasionally religion does make the front pages of our newspapers, and usually when it does, it's for one reason, and that it's associated with one or another form of violence. It could be sexual violence, it could be wartime forms of violence. So as Martin Marty has said, the reason that religion gets on prime time is because it kills. And certainly that's not the only thing that religion does, but the what I call the bright side of religion, there's no real reason for us to be too concerned about the bright side because it's bright. But it's the dark side of religion that I think we need to be concerned about, or that I'm certainly concerned about, because it can enable people to kill other people.
Right. Why, like, we're going to talk now about why that is the case, and certainly we can all think of many positive aspects of religion, but I attended a talk that you gave last night at the University of Edinburgh, and one thing that you were saying is that religion, whilst not necessarily, you know, causing violence, it is a very potent enabling mechanism for violence. I think that would be a good place for us to start, if you could talk about what you mean by an enabling mechanism.
Yes, I think we need to go back a little bit in time to understand, to put it in the big picture, as it were. Very often we get so caught up with the trees that we can't see the forest. And particularly today, when we think of religious violence, the first thing that pops into people's minds is Islamic or Islamic-based violence. And we tend to think that it is a particular doctrine in a particular faith, for example, the doctrine of jihad, that is responsible for violence, in this case, violence in religion, but particularly violence in Islam. And while I don't deny the importance of the doctrinal understandings, I think that we make, especially in the West today, we make a very great error if we think that this problem is unique to any single faith. It's my position that it is, in a sense, built into all major religious traditions. Now the question is, why is that? And what proof do I have? All right. So I think we have to go back to a wonderful, and I think a great insight that was first elaborated upon or pointed out by Karl Jaspers, the German philosopher. He pointed to something that he identified he coined the phrase the Axial Age. And he said that this Axial Age started in India, China, Greece, the Middle East, depending on the country, between 800 and 200 BCE, so before the Common Era. And what his basic insight, which I support fully, is that up until that time, religions had been basically tribal in nature. That is, each tribal group had its own religious faith, and they didn't actually think that their religious faith was universal in scope. It was for their tribe. They recognized there were other faiths, other gods for other tribes. But during this period, you have great religious leaders coming forth, China, Confucius, India, the Buddha, Greece, ancient Greece, Socrates, in Judaism, Deutero, Isaiah. And they came to the conclusion that the religious faith that they understood was universally true, not just for their tribe or for their people, but for all peoples. And that, of course, led to the world religion, to the idea or even the possibility, perhaps, of a world religion. So now we have a series of world religions. We have five great world religions. But my critique of Karl Jaspers is this, and that is, there it seems you get the impression that universal religion took over and basically eradicated tribal religion, except maybe in the dark, deep jungles of the Amazon or somewhere. But I see that as a misunderstanding, because it's my point of view, from my study, leads me to believe that it is not a question that universal religion totally supplanted tribal religion, but that it is layered over tribal religion. Yeah. And that what we see in what is called the bright side of religion, as it were, is these universal aspects. But what we fail to understand is that when believers of a universal religion are threatened or feel threatened, that they will unconsciously, even without being aware of it, revert back to a tribal mentality in which my religion is for not for my tribe anymore, but basically for my country and for my nation. And out of that, for example, come some very popular ideas like for God and country. And people easily accept the idea that what is done for God is, or particularly what is done for my country, is done for God. And yet, when you look at the teachings of Jesus, there is no sense of country within these teachings. The greatest sense is universal good. But yet we take that, all faiths take it, and reduce it down to the good that, on the one hand, it's couched in the terminology of a universal good, but in practice it is the good of my people and of my country. So when I'm talking about enabling mechanisms, what I'm really talking about is that every major faith has this universal bright side of love and compassion, words like love and compassion that extend to all human beings, sentient beings, sometimes even to nature itself. And that in times of peace, you hear and see, and the practice, not only do you hear it on your sermons in the Christian tradition, for example, on Sunday morning, but you see it in many ways in which Christians practice love of neighbor. But when they come under threat, when their nation comes under threat, suddenly it is my God and my country becomes synonymous, and we go to war in the name, in the belief that my God will protect my country and my people. And so that's what I call an enabling mechanism in religion.
I don't know if you're going to want to push this analogy in this interview, but you certainly did in your article, and I really liked it, of religion being like a plane, where, well, I'll let you say it, but, you know, essentially the plane itself, the religion itself, is not, it's neutral in that sense. And maybe we could, you'd say a little bit about that, and then maybe we could proceed from there through to these universal characteristics of what we could call holy war, really.
Yes. Yeah, so I use the analogy, of course, the plane comes from 9/11 in the United States, and for example, where I differ from a person, someone like Christopher Hitchens, he believes that religion, that the inclination to violence is built into religion itself. In my position, that no, it's not. It is certainly, it has been, because of our tribal past and our national and our nation state present, that religion certainly has been used by the tribe and used by the nation state to promote its interest. And I would suggest, I call that the hijacking of religion. But you can see at certain times and certain leaders, religious leaders, have transcended that consistently. But quite frankly, they've usually been in the minority to this point. The question is, can they grow? Can we grow? Not just they grow, but can we grow beyond that? And so I say, yes, it is possible, because just as an aircraft can be used to drop bombs on people.
Yeah.
It can be used to transport people safely from point A to point B. And who determines how it will be used? It is, in this case, the pilots, the people who fund the aircraft. They decide its mission. So it's not religion that's the problem. If we want to identify the problem, it is the people who are operating and who fund the aircraft. They're the ones who determine its goals.
So if we can proceed through a brief discussion with maybe a few examples from a few diverse traditions, because
yes,
obviously we don't want to be pinning things on one particular tradition, of why religion is such an effective enabling mechanism. What were the characteristics of religion that make it so effective?
Well, I think the root effectiveness of religion as an enabling mechanism for violence is that it is probably the preeminent device for engaging not just our mind, but more importantly, for our emotions. And that when you can engage a person's mind and emotions, then whoever can do that successfully has a very potent tool to enable to make the good soldier, to enhance the soldier's morale, prowess, determination, and not simply the soldier, but the people on the so-called home front, if they believe their loved one is engaged in a good and worthy and therefore a holy cause, they're doing God's work, then you've got a combination that's very difficult. I mean, it could be defeated militarily, of course, but still, they will become truly the most engaged and dedicated soldier if they have that religious fervor that can only come, again, from religious belief. Now, nationalism certainly is another potent tool to motivate soldiers on the battlefront to fight for my nation. But if you can somehow, it's not simply my nation, but I'm fighting for truth and justice, then you just simply enhance that. They take the nationalism even a further step, because people are looking for something beyond self, and they are looking for something beyond nation, and universal religion appears to provide that. Now, for a couple of examples, and this is what's so difficult about, and this is why I say it's so important to understand tribal religion versus universal religion, is because today what happens is that the universal tenets, without our even realizing it, can become, what I maintain, can become tribalized. Well, let me give you an example. We have, in the Christian tradition, you have a doctrine of heaven. Mm-hmm. Now, heaven doesn't seem to be violent. In fact, it seems to be the very opposite of violent. A perfect, peaceful, wonderful place. And it is the reward for people who, it's traditionally seen as a reward for people who've lived pious, dedicated lives to helping others, following the tenets of their faith and of Christianity. And that seems to be, on the surface, the farthest thing away from a violence-enabling mechanism. Mm-hmm. And yet, just as recently as a few, in the newspaper, there was an article, I'm from Ohio, in Cleveland is one of the major cities, and they had an article about a Sergeant Garmbach who was killed in Iraq. His body was sent back to the United States, and there was a funeral for him. And his pastor, who happened to be a Roman Catholic, his pastor said, you know, Sergeant Garmbach knows something about love for his fellow man. He served in Iraq with distinction. He was known always to support his fellow soldiers. And in this case, he was supporting a fellow soldier when he was fatally injured and killed. And we know that people who are concerned about others, that they have a special place in God's heart. And we know on that basis that Sergeant Garmbach has gone home to peace. He is with God today. It's painful for us who are left to accept that, but we know that he is now at peace, and he is with God. And everyone in the church, according to the newspaper article, was weeping and nodding their heads. So what do I make of that? I'm not here to deny that Sergeant Garmbach went to heaven, but I am here to suggest that this is a very potent way, mechanism, to reconcile a soldier's death. Because why? Do we know how many Iraqis Sergeant Garmbach killed on the way to getting killed himself? No. No discussion about that. No discussion about the fact that we know there's always collateral damage in warfare today. But simply, it is presented that because he helped his fellow soldier, that this was a Christian act, and therefore his reward was one of heaven. So heaven itself then becomes, I call it, the weaponization of heaven in order to enable to continue. Suppose, for example, people have come back and said, we know that, you know, but anyway, suppose that that mechanism had not been there to reconcile the family to his loss. They might well have said, we've got to stop this war, yeah, because no more, we don't want anyone else's sons or daughters to experience what we're experiencing. Mm. But that's not the way it's done. Now let me give you another example. In Judaism, for example, Judaism has the belief that they are the chosen people of God. Now, that if you ask a pious Jew, well, isn't that idea of being about being the chosen people, not just a, but the chosen people, isn't that arrogant? And they'll say, oh no, you don't understand. To be chosen is not a terrible burden, but it's a responsibility that we have, that Jews have, to be the light unto the world by leading, by showing what pious lives, what true faith is like through our own lives. We're exemplars to the people of the world of what a religious life could and should be. So it's not that we have any special rights, but actually we have special duties. Yet, if you go today to the West Bank of Israel and you ask the settlers, especially the religious settlers, why they are there and what right do they have to take the Palestinian people's land, they'll say, God gave us this property, this land. We're after 2,000 years, we have come back to redeem what God gave us and we were driven from. And these Palestinians don't belong here because they are not part of the covenant with God. And so in that case, chosenness simply enables them to act violently and drive the Palestinians from what they believe to be their God-given rights. So that's what I'm trying to say. This violence enabling mechanism is so difficult to discern because it always has a bright side.
Yeah.
And when you challenge a religious believer about that, they will always respond with, oh, you don't understand. There's the bright side. For example, you challenge a Muslim about jihad, and they'll come back, oh, you don't understand. Jihad is a struggle within ourselves. Right? That's the great jihad. That's this minor one. Yes, it's true, but it's only when we are defending our faith from someone who's encroaching against us. So, but yet, when it's necessary, it's like almost like having everybody has a library, and you have a whole bunch of, and I see here, Chris, you've got a whole bunch of books here.
Yeah.
And I'm certain most of them are giving the bright side of religion, right? But yet, you know that if the need arises, you can pull out the book that will justify. That will take the very same doctrines that seem so peaceful and loving and compassionate, and you can take out the very same doctrine and flip it, and suddenly it becomes an enabling mechanism for religious violence.
And we don't want to be seen to be picking on religion here. I mean, any ism will have a bright side and a dark side. But
yes.
What we're doing is we're discussing religion because that's what the podcast is about. That's what your research is about.
That's right.
And we're, you know, just saying, look, yes, there's bright sides, but there's also dark sides. I'm very aware that time is moving on. So I might say that the other specifics of the article, for example, that people please do visit the website and have a read of it. But maybe we should move on more specifically to Buddhism now. And we have a real stereotype in the West. It's a positive stereotype, but that Eastern religions are very peaceful. Certainly the fundamental tenets you were saying yesterday on Buddhism is no harm to other life, be that human life or animal life. Is this an accurate stereotype? Why do we have this stereotype?
Yes. Well, one reason we have the stereotype is because Buddhism is still relatively new to the West.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is Westerners' own desire to deceive themselves. And what do I mean by that? I mean, you know, especially in the United States, it was in the 1960s. It's very, you know, I often say this is a little bit of a crude analogy, but the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence until, and this is my part of it, until we get over to the other side of the fence and we discover that they use the same human manure to fertilize the grass on that side of the fence than they do on our side of the fence. Well, I think in the so-called hippie movement in California, etc., they saw that, you know, they were well aware, especially because Christianity was was a major enabling mechanism for the conduct of the Vietnam War. We were fighting, America was fighting the godless communists, right?
Yep.
And we had God at our side fighting the atheists. So they saw that use of Christianity and reacted against it. And they wanted something to replace it. And Buddhism seemed, aha. I mean, after all, how violent can somebody sitting on a cushion meditating be?
Well, that's what we're going to find out about.
That's right. So I think in that sense, you know, it's not simply that the Buddhists hid their violent past, but that the Westerners who were looking to Buddhism wanted to find the antidote, wanted to find something that was not like what they were rejecting. So I think that's at least part of it.
Yeah.
All right. Now, the other part of it, of course, is that Buddhist leaders have indeed presented themselves as paragons. For example, D.T. Suzuki, in his famous book, Zen and Japanese Culture, right in the introduction says that in its 2,500-year history, Buddhism has never been engaged in warfare. I read that when I was, as my youth, like, wow, that is so different from Christianity. Sign me up right there. But then, of course, as you, and the reason that, for example, my book Zen at War has had such an impact is because it's been a very sobering realization for those of us in the West, and even to some degree in Japan itself, for them to realize how deeply involved, supportive the Buddhist establishment across the board, across all sects, was of Japanese militarism. And naturally, people want to forget that in Japan, let alone they didn't know it in the West, and they wanted to forget it. And so the Zen masters, for example, who came to America after World War II, certainly didn't mention that part of their own past either. But anyway, coming to your question, how could Buddhism then, when people are, you know, sitting meditating or chanting sutras, how violent can that be? Unfortunately, it can be. Sitting on the cushion is not the problem. It's what do you do with the insight that you gain through sitting on the cushion, because there are no Buddhists who sit on cushions their entire lives. One of the things that is possible to achieve through meditation is something called samadhi power. And this is a one-pointedness of mind that can be achieved through meditation. Mm. Now, there is a Buddhist form of this insight meditation, which is used to understand the self, but that very same psychic power, if we want to use those words, psychic power, can be directed toward anything. So it can be, you can take it, the student can take that psychic power and devote themselves truly, thoroughly, devote themselves to whatever topic, whatever, to the book they're reading, to the thought they're, even to the thoughts they're thinking, very hone in on that and experience depths of understanding that they couldn't otherwise do with a concentrated state of mind. But you can easily see that a warrior also needs a concentrated state of mind. It's kill or be killed. And so they can take that power with them to the battlefield, which is what Japan's traditional, the warrior class, the samurai, the reason they meditated was they understood that this was a method of preparation, a method of mental preparation for the battlefield.
For killing and for being killed.
And for being killed, yes. Now you say, well, But a Buddhist has said their first precept is do not kill. How does that work? Well, the basic Buddhist understanding is that there was a belief in an eternal soul called an Atman in classical India. The Buddha's insight was an-Atman, which means no eternal soul. There is no eternal soul from a Buddhist point of view. Well, that doesn't seem too violent. All right, I mean, we can argue about whether there is or whether there isn't, but that doesn't have much to do with violence. But yet, the next generations after, there was a great Buddhist philosopher called Nagarjuna, and he said that based on the fact that the Buddha said there is no self, means that if the self doesn't exist, and why doesn't the self exist from a Buddhist point of view? Because everything is in a constant state of change, of flux, of impermanence. And that applies to the self. All right? Well, then what does that ultimately mean? That it means that the true nature of the universe, including the self, is ultimately empty. Shunyata. Now, if everything is ultimately empty, then what happens when killing takes place? If you are ultimately empty, and I am ultimately empty, if I kill you, I haven't changed anything, because you didn't really exist, and if I'm killed, nothing has changed because I really didn't exist. And therefore, when for the enlightened person who understands the nature of emptiness, they can kill and be killed without even breaking the precept of not killing. So, the classical understanding of Buddhism is that once you understand the emptiness of all things, you identify with all things and recognize. And one of the Buddha's famous statements was, no one wants to be harmed, no one wants to be killed. Inasmuch as you are like unto them, do not kill or slay.
Sort of the golden rule.
The golden rule. Right? But yet if you recognize emptiness, then suddenly you're free from that, which is what happened to Buddhism, especially Zen Buddhism, when it was introduced into Japan, because at that time, when it was introduced in the 1200s, the warrior class in Japan was in power. And they needed a metaphysic that allowed them to pursue their profession and prepare them to pursue their profession. And the disciplined Zen monastic life lent itself to martial preparation. Now, to give another example, the doctrine of karma. Mm-hmm. Now, karma is if you do good, good comes back. If you do bad, bad comes back to you. That doesn't seem particularly violent. But yet, what it can be used, much like heaven is used, during World War II, for example, when the Japanese soldiers were killed and their funeral was given for them, the question is, why were they killed on the battlefield? Because they had evidently done something evil in their past life or past lives, and this was their just recompense. Mm-hmm. And, more important, no one could be blamed for that other than themselves. It couldn't have been the emperor who sent them into battle. It couldn't have been the enemy, even. It was all made, it had to be because of what they themselves had done. Now that sounds pretty negative, but it's got a positive side. And that is, if they went to the battlefield and they were killed honorably, that was a good act. And as a result of that good act, they would be reborn. Where? in Japan. And so these new children who were being born, you couldn't, now the Tibetans actually believe you could recognize these past, the Dalai Lamas from the past. The Japanese never went that far. But they said these new children, you won't know them as your old, your son will not, the child will not, well, I'm really your son that was just, that died on the battlefield. You won't recognize them, but you know that that is their just reward for having died for their country and for their emperor and for, to protect their family, etc. So it's not all as negative as it seems, but the point is, it does serve again to do what? To make, to lessen the pain of the loss and to make it all seem somehow just in the nature of things.
We're running out of time. We're pretty much out of time, unfortunately. If only our listeners could have been there yesterday for a full hour on a sort of really intricate case study.
Especially that we haven't really talked about how compassion fits into this. But we'll have to wait.
Just to close, returning to the broader religion and violence, why should scholars care? Why does it matter?
Well, one of the few times that mass media reporters call up departments of religion is to get, well, you know, this terrorist act just happened. What do you think about that? Well, that's not my specialty. I mean, that works. But again, it's like what Martin Marty said, that what keeps religion on the front pages is that it can kill. And therefore, if religious studies scholars or scholars of religion are not able to address that issue, they're not able to really address one of the fundamental problems, as it were, of religion in society, in today's society. So I think that's a very pragmatic reason. But a deeper reason is that I think in the heart of every religious scholar, even if they don't believe this or that particular faith, they want religion to matter. And I think they want it to matter in a positive way. They want to see religion as being a positive force. So we see that in a sense, and we want that, and yet we see also this dark side of religion. And if we're unable to address it and understand it, how can we ever hope together? How can we ever hope if we don't understand why it's there, and we can't even begin to understand what could change, must change? What can we do about it together with, of course, religious leaders, etc.? So I think that the reason religious scholars should care about it is because if they don't care about it, religion will become exactly what Christopher Hitchens has called it when in his last book, God is Not Great. It will also become religion is not great. And when religion is not great, religion is not necessary. And its purpose and its usefulness and its bright side will be, it'll be like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And we'll be left without religion. And that, when you think of the wonderful things religion has done and can do, what a tragedy that would be.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Professor Brian Victoria. It's been wonderful to speak with you.
Thank you.
That was Chris talking to Brian Victoria on the subject of Zen Buddhism and violence. And if you enjoyed that podcast, make sure you come back on Wednesday, and we'll be publishing an excellent response to this interview from Kevin Whitesides, who you may remember from many of the roundtables we recorded last year. And that interview ends our short series on the idea of the sacred in religious studies. Next week, we'll be having one of our edited episodes, this time on the subject of what is the public benefit of the academic study of religion, a topic that was sparked by, first of all, by a debate at the BASR conference in September this year, but also by the larger question of public engagement and the relative impoverishment of religious studies within the public sphere. So we hope you join us for what's going to be a very interesting episode. And on Friday, of course, come back for our Opportunities Digest, which is also now available in PDF form. It's been a busy week here at Religious Studies Project Towers. We
have been having many discussions behind the scenes about next year. We've been hatching some big plans for Christmas time, which we can't quite announce yet, but hopefully soon. And we've been recording interviews with people like Jim Cox and Anne Tavez and lots of other people, not only here in Edinburgh, but at the SSSR and at the AAR conference in Chicago, which is still on this weekend as I record. You can, as always, leave comments on the site. The comments are now working again, so please do get involved there, or on the Facebook page if you prefer, or on our Twitter feed at ProjectRS. As always, I'll ask if you listen to this podcast using iTunes, if you would take a moment to rate us, we'd be highly grateful. It's down at the bottom on the left-hand side. And other than that, all that remains to say is thanks for listening.